The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
On today's episode, part one of my conversation with Anton Lucky and his redemptive path forward from incarceration to a life of activism.
And I accepted everything that happened up until that point. You know, because I didn't want to be the one who blamed it on the system. I didn't want to be the one who blamed it on my mother. I didn't want to be the one who blamed it on my father not being there. Because at the end of the day, I had to accept that I made the choices that I made. And for me to get to the next stage in my life, I had to accept that. I couldn't blame nobody else for that. I had to accept it.
Hey, welcome to The Dose, a show dedicated to deep and engaging conversations, highlighting individuals that are in the pursuit of authentic and courageous leadership, who approach life with insatiable curiosity, bold action, and common sense in these divisive and uncommon times. It's my hope you take something away from each and every one of these conversations and apply it to your own life, as we all intentionally attempt to become the best we can possibly be by living out our purpose and calling, committing to a life of service, and helping make this place better than we found it.
What a thrill and honor to have Anton Lucky on the show. Anton was the founder of the 415 Dallas Bloods Gang, who eventually transformed himself into this redemptive leader and impactful activist. This is such an inspirational and aspirational story of adversity, personal accountability, radical empathy, and contrarian activism. You are going to be so moved with the story. In fact, it's going to be a two-parter. We could only get through on this first episode up to the point where he was born through his descent into the drug culture, the founding of the Dallas Bloods, and eventually in prison, and that's when the transformative process began. And then we'll do part two next week, where it brings him up to his present day and all the, again, contrarian activism that Anton has been a part of. Again, this is a story of his descent into the futile hopelessness of gang culture, his spiritual and leadership awakening in prison, and again, that contrarian activism that he's doing today. You are going to be inspired by this amazing story. Anton's dynamic energy of compassion and complete understanding is unlike anything you've ever heard. And so let's get on with this amazing conversation, part one, with one and only Anton Lucky here on The Dose.
Welcome to the show, my friend.
Man, thank you for having me. It's a privilege to be here.
Well, it's been a while since we last talked. You know, we were put together and still hopeful. Get this pitch of your story. It needs to be told, but hey, it's going to be told here in Dose of Leadership today.
Yes,
so
indeed.
I feel privileged that you're here sitting. Man, there's so much to talk about with you. And I think just up front, like I was asking you before, what do you want to make sure gets across? This is a story of redemption. It's probably one of the most powerful redemption stories I've ever come across.
Thank you.
It almost seems not to even be real. Like this can't even be true. Like, you could even write a story like this. Right? You write this story and Hollywood say, oh, come on.
Yeah.
You know. So started in Dallas. You're still living in Dallas, right? I mean,
Yeah, I'm still here. Born and raised.
1976, parents brought forth this world, Anton Lucky, in an East Dallas housing project, right?
Right.
That's kind of where it all started.
Yeah.
So you grew up in the projects and give me a sense of that. What were your mom and dad like? I mean, how old were they? I don't think I ever got a sense of how old your mom and dad were.
My mother was 16. My dad was 17, right? When they met probably when she was like 15, 14, but mother was 16 when she had me. My dad was 17. But what had happened when I was 9 months old, my dad was sentenced to prison. 50 years in prison, 9 months. He ultimately did 37 years flat in prison. And so, for me, right, growing up in the projects, you know, in that community, when that happened, my mother closed the door on that situation. She closed the door. And unfortunately for me, no one, I mean, absolutely no one explained to me as I began to get a little older, you know, as a kid, you know, what was the situation with my father and who he was. It was just like he disappeared, like he was no longer.
Yeah, he was never a factor in your life as far as your earliest memory.
Right. Right. He was never, he wasn't even a factor. But as a kid, I grew up wanting to know. You know, as a kid, Rich, you want to know. You want to know who this is. But the interesting thing about it was I felt dumb to even ask that question.
Really?
I felt dumb. Like, I wanted to know, but it was like this feeling of, like, you feel dumb, like, asking that kind of question. I'm asking about, did I have to be, as a kid, ask questions about my father? I remember feeling.
So, because when you asked it, it was just too painful?
Well, it's not just that it's painful. It's just, for me as a kid, I felt like that's something that I should have already known, or somebody should have told me. Somebody should have had that conversation to me. I should never been put in a position where I had to ask. You know, it should have been relayed to me, or conveyed to me, and no one conveyed it to me. Like I said, my mother closed that chapter, and that chapter was gone. No matter how I looked at it, the chapter was closed for her. She closed that chapter for whatever her reasons were, and no one else decided that it was important for me to know that.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, put it, trying to think, you know, here she is, she's 17,
mm-hmm.
No man in the house. She's trying, she's not even a legal adult. She's trying to raise
right.
you. And,
right.
And I imagine there was probably a string of men that probably came in.
Right.
You know, your earliest memory of men were probably, I mean, she was probably, right? I mean,
right.
Didn't she have a string of men coming through her life?
Yes, I had, it was actually two, that came along my sibling's father came, and he was with us for a couple of years. Then he left. And then another guy came in, seemingly nice guy. He ended up doing, he ended up doing drugs, and so he left. And so, but no one, again, no one was particularly interested in making sure that I knew who my father was. And I, as a kid, wanted to know. I wanted to know that. I wanted to have those conversations, but it just didn't feel right having those conversations, because I think when I look back on it in hindsight, I think me not having my father there, and when I started realizing that he wasn't there, et cetera, by looking at some of the kids at school who had fathers, all kids who had fathers in their home, I started to realize, like. And I wanted to know. That's when I really wanted to know, like, what was going on, you know, what's up with my father, et cetera, et cetera. But again, it didn't feel natural for me to ask those questions. I mean, maybe, you know, as a kid, you know, the range of emotions and feelings that I was going through, I didn't have the opportunity to share them with no one. I mean, I couldn't share them with nobody. I just had to. And it made me observe. It made me pay attention more, though. It made me very observant to a lot of stuff, probably too early at an early age.
Well, yeah, you were exposed to things that you really weren't mm-hmm. emotionally prepared for. But I mean, that's just the I mean, you're just one example of, you know, this happens to millions of
right
kids all the time. And this cycle where, you know, here, no positive male role model.
Right.
Your real father's gone. You don't know where he's at. You're seeing kids in your school that do have kids, you're afraid to ask about it. Your mom doesn't, you know, she's trying to work
and work, figure it out.
And she doesn't have enough energy
right.
when she comes home after a hard day of work.
Right.
And so, I mean,
right.
we can see how this happens. And so what happens? So you gravitate
right
towards the street, towards where you do have this familial sense, where you do have
right.
this male influence, this kind of bonding and this testosterone, which right. a lot of people, you know, as two guys, we understand that, right?
Right,
and
right.
Sometimes,
right.
And not to take anything away from your mother at
right.
all.
Right, because she did, you know, she was doing the best she could, but she was, like you said earlier, she was a kid herself. But I'm gonna tell you before I gravitated towards the streets, though, it's interesting to point out that I put a lot of my before the streets, I put a lot of my time and focus in school. Like,
yeah, and you were a great student, right?
Right.
I mean, you were like kicking ass in school.
A on the roll.
It came to you naturally.
Talented and gifted. Yeah. That was my refuge. School was my refuge. You know, straight A student, talented and gifted student. Because in my home life, my mother worked. She worked long hours to provide a roof and food on the table. So the only other place that I could find some type of solace was in school. So I applied myself there. And I love that. And I love, you know, coming home, bringing good grades home. My grandparents were like my primary caretakers. So they encouraged me. They loved me. They kissed on me. They gave me the love that I wasn't getting from my father, and in most cases from my mother, right? But I tell you, that's not the kicker. It wasn't no match for when I walked out the door, or what I dealt with.
Pressure, right?
Yeah, that pressure.
Pressure of being in, right?
Right.
That pressure of being in.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's what's so sad, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just makes you ache thinking about here. You have all this, you know, potential.
Right.
You see, you've got the potential in this really crappy circumstance.
Right, right.
And then the forces just suck you in.
The forces
suck you in.
It take over. I mean, it takes over because it you know, and I couldn't understand like back then. I couldn't. That's why I work so hard at the stuff I do now, because I couldn't understand like back then. Kids were, and I'm quite sure it's some of that today, but back then it was like we came from the same environment, you know, same situation, poverty, you know, a lot of our fathers weren't in the home. And you have some that were, but most part it wasn't. We was dealing with the same issues in terms of the community stuff, but it was like it was innate in kids to just see you as an enemy. You know, and I never understood that. Like kids would just, you know, kids from different neighborhoods, like 1 mile up the street, saw you as, it was ingrained in them to see you as an enemy. And I never understood that, you know, so going to school each day, especially when I was going to a school in a different neighborhood than mine, where they were busing us to another school, every day my survival depended on two things, you know, how fast I can run, if I miss that school bus, or how hard I can fight. That became like my daily struggle. And so, you know, you 10, 11, 12 years old, and you have to worry about, you know, who you're going to fight after school, and that becomes your life. You can tell how my grades started, you know, you can understand how my grades started to slip.
There was kind of a turning point. I remember reading in your manuscript in your book about kind of this time as you're, to me, I think it's one of those inflection points where it started going down that path. It was when you were kind of forced in an initiation fight with one of your best friends, Rodney. Tell us a little bit about that. Like what happened?
Man, Rodney was my friend. Rodney was, man, this was my boy. You know, we would walk to school every day, come home every day, you know, played every day. You know, this was my friend. I really enjoyed it, my friend. And my cousins, right? My cousins, they were way more sinister, right? They were very more sinister in the friends because they were a little bit older than me. And so one day after school, they put me and Rodney up to fight, right? You know, we had these initiations where you had to fight, you know, where they put the stick on your shoulder and whoever knocked the stick off, and then that's the bell. And I remember coming home, I mean, getting out of school that day and not knowing, and they faced me and Rodney towards each other to fight. And me and Rodney, we both were looking like, whoa, like we didn't, you know, we both, you could tell that he didn't want to and I didn't either, right? But we was kind of like, the peer pressure was that we had to do it. You know, we couldn't turn away. We had all the kids were hunched over, laughing and snickering and, you know, and all that. And so they put the sticks on me and Rodney's shoulder, right? And I remember, man, not having the courage to walk away from that situation. I felt so bad because I didn't have the courage to walk away from that situation. And I actually went through with that. I knocked the stick off. Me and Rodney started fighting, right? And all I can hear is just the kids taunting us, laughing, and, you know, egging us on, et cetera, et cetera. And I felt bad. I mean, I felt real bad afterwards going home, because Rodney was my friend. But I didn't have the courage to walk away from that. I didn't have the courage to stand up to my cousins and my friends who had egged that on and put that on. And so, yeah, that bothered me. I mean, that was kind of like the first incident that I had where I had to fight, where I had to participate in the shenanigans, you know, in my neighborhood.
Yeah, and a month later, he drowns.
Right.
So you never had this kind of,
right.
You never kind of fully had a chance to talk with them about it. And if I remember correctly, you felt like you'd been punished for this cowardice that you were talking about here, right? You felt like you were punished, right?
I did. I really did. I remember when our teacher had broke the news to us that Rodney had drowned, it was like a thud in my chest, like some drop. And I remember sitting in the class feeling like the universe was punishing me some kind of way. Like I was responsible. That's how I felt like. I felt like I was responsible. Like some kind of way the universe caused that to happen, because I didn't have the courage to walk away from that. You know, because Rodney and myself, we were very traumatized by that situation. And I felt like it was the universe doing something to me by allowing Rodney to drown, you know, and just the thought that I would never see him again, you know, that was the real kicker. Like that's my first understanding of introduction of death, you know, that he ain't coming back.
And you're in the third grade, is that right? It's too young, man.
Right. And I had another incident that happened similar afterwards. And when I look back at it, I think a lot of those incidents, those two particular incidents, I'm going to tell you about another one, I think kind of shaped me later on in life, because I had another friend that I was friends with. He was a kid from Ethiopia. He was in a orphanage, right? It was called a Buckner School Home, you know, and they had kids from like Ethiopia, you know, war-torn countries where they were sitting these kids in. And I had a friend named Abdul. This was like my friend. We were equal in classroom. Like he was smart. We both were smart. We both loved education. We was A and B, everything, right? And that was my friend, man. And we sat next to each other in class, and I loved talking to him, et cetera, et cetera. He made me feel better because he didn't have no family. You know, I didn't have my father, but he had no family. He didn't know where his family was.
He's an orphan.
Yeah, he was an orphan, so he had nothing. And his, you know, just getting to know him and listening to his situation made me feel like, made me grateful of my situation, because his situation was dire. But every day he came to school, you know, he had this hunger for education and learning, because he was learning our culture, you know, American culture. So, and that was my friend. But my cousins, again, they were bullies. They were bad. They were sinister, right? And so they would jump on kids and all that good stuff. And so, and I remember bad stuff, not good stuff, bad stuff. And so I remember one day coming around a corner in school, and one of my cousins, he had Abdul jacked up against a locker, right? And I knew what he was doing, you know, my cousin. He had him jacked up against the locker. And I remember when I come around the corner, I seen it, and I stepped back around the corner out of eyesight. I didn't want Abdul to see me. I didn't want Abdul to know that was my cousin. And I stepped back out of eyesight, right? And I went back around. I didn't want to see it. And so the next day, he came to school and he had a black eye, right? And I knew why he had that black eye. And I remember like feeling so my insides felt so bad because, again, here it is again. If this was in fifth grade, that I didn't have the courage to stand up. Yeah. You know, it's like this thing. I didn't have the courage to stand up and defend. I was ashamed to say Abdul was my friend outside of the classroom, you know, because he didn't have the status socially accepted, so I didn't. So that was a thing, you know, and it was similar to Rodney, that I didn't have the courage, and that's bothered me for a long time. That bothered me.
Whatever happened to Abdul?
I never knew, because my mother ended up transferring me from that school, because we were bused to that school. She ended up they ended up redistricting, and they sent us to another school. But I never knew.
Is this when you start? Yeah, you never knew.
Yeah.
So you're going to South Dallas. So this is when you go to South Dallas, when you get bused, is that right?
Right.
So in the book, you said it might as well be going to North Korea, basically, right?
I mean,
this is like going into
enemy territory.
Foreign country. Yes. Enemy territory.
Right.
So is this, are you already kind of dipping your foot in the gang culture at this point, or are you still kind of keeping yourself out of it by the time you go to South Dallas?
Well, I'm still keeping myself out of it. I'm living this duality, this dual life. So I'm in this classroom, I'm trying to excel, you know, focus on my work. But my cousins and friends, they had a reputation. So I would walk this fine line of kind of being around them, but not participating, you know. And so I'm, but at the particular time, we hadn't got into the gang understanding. In our minds, we were just, you know, representing or either defending our neighborhood, because it was neighborhoods by neighborhoods by which a lot of these confrontations happened. So it hadn't turned to the gang stuff yet, but it was on its way. It was definitely on its way.
Now you get thrown into enemy territory.
Right.
As far as they're concerned, I mean, you come from a rival neighborhood. You're going to a school in a rival neighborhood. You're not in the gang culture, but you become a target, obviously, right?
Yes.
Hey, that's so-and-so's cousin, man.
Right. And then all these kids at this particular time, they were involved. They were gang involved.
Yeah.
You know? And I remember at a time when I thought that was weird. I thought that was odd. I didn't understand because these kids were wearing blue bandanas and they were throwing up gang signs. I can remember a time when I thought that was kind of odd and weird and awkward and all that good. I didn't understand it. But these kids were already affiliated, and they would fight us. They would pick on us. We were the kids that they picked on because we weren't affiliated with a gang. And so that became kind of like the introduction, first stage into us starting to think in terms of gang.
So now you start hanging out at your local car wash and started learning the hustle of the life, right?
Right.
But so you've got these established gang members, you're trying to stay out of it, but now they're starting to pay you to wash their cars, right?
I mean,
that's kind of the entry level thing, right? And so you're making, like, what kind of money are we making just cleaning their cars?
When we first started out, for the local drug dealers, they would give us like $5 to wash their white wall. That's back when the white walls were
a thing.
Gangster white walls, the gangster white walls. And so we would wash their white walls. All we had to have was an SOS pad to get them white. And so we started out washing their white walls. And these was the hustlers, man. They were making money, and they would give us, I mean, they would pull out a water money, water cash, give everybody $5. But we washing their white walls, right? We started out washing their white walls. And when we realized they would pay us for that, we would come faithfully every day after school to the car wash to wash their white walls, because that's how we ate. You know, that's how you get out the swimming pool. Yeah. You get out the swimming pool, you hungry. You getting out of school, you hungry. We knew intuitively that if we went to the car wash and watch the drug dealers' cars, they were going to give us money. And that became an everyday occurrence for us.
So it's almost kind of like, I don't know if they were intentionally grooming, but it's almost like a grooming phase, right?
Right.
And you got this, you see, they find the entrepreneurs in
right.
right? The hustlers in there. And
right.
you've got this kind of entrepreneurial genetic mindset.
Right.
You know, you go and you're still in SOS pads, you know, and then and I can make $5 to, yeah. You go get your candy or your Burger King or whatever after you're done. And
yeah.
And that's good to go. Now,
yeah.
I'm sure they're probably seeing that kind of entrepreneurial hustler mindset.
Oh, yeah.
It's only a matter of time where they go, hey, man, why don't you be a lookout for me and I'll give you whatever.
Right.
Right. Right. And now it's a step up, right?
That's exactly how it happened because we would come to the car wash regularly, right? And I'm talking about me and my cousins and friends, sometimes we would get into fist fights over who gonna wash the cars and
except, yeah.
Right. And so the drug dealers, they were watching us, right? They were looking at us saying, these kids hungry. They coming regularly. You know, they fighting over who gonna do the cars. You know, so they start saying there's something different about them. They not just regular kids. It's something different. They have more aptitude than the other kids. Cause the other kids, you know, they came one or two times, they never came back. But we were coming every day washing their cars because them $5 started stacking up. You know, some days we leave with $15. That's a lot of money for a kid. Yeah.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah. And here they are. Now you're doing lookouts and not only you're probably making a lot more money being a lookout because now you got skin in the game now.
Oh yeah. They told us, they say, look, all you guys have to do, because we ride our bikes to the car wash. They say, we're going to give you $20 a day. All you have to do is ride your bike up and down this street. And every time you see the police, you holler headache. You holler headache as loud as you can. Every time you see the police, that's all you had to do. And here we is, we riding our bikes up and down the street. And every time we see a police car come, we holler headache. So then, you know. So then they said, and I remember too, because my mother used to ride the city transportation, the Dart bus, past that car wash when she get off work. Every day, faithfully at 4:45, I knew that bus was coming and my mother was on it. And she going to be looking dead at that car wash because she knew what was going on. And every day, faithfully, I would duck behind a car, a building. When at 4:45,
she
couldn't see me. Yeah, so and so that eventually, when they saw that we were doing that faithfully, and you're right, they could have been grooming us. Then we graduated. Then we really graduated to they saying, hey, you can be a lookout or you can be a seller. Seller make this, lookout make this, person hold the money make this. And we like, what? You know, you for real?
That's a lot of money.
Yeah. So yeah.
One thing that stood out to me in the book was when you talked about even when you graduate to these phases, you know, and crack cocaine is really taking off. Now, we're talking about the early 90s. Crack cocaine is just a full-on epidemic.
Right, right.
And you found a way, or maybe you learned a way, how to manufacture fake cocaine by crystallizing a B12 supplement combining with Aura gel and Coca-Cola, which I was like, what in the hell? So here you are for $15, you buy this material, that's going to net you $1,000.
Right.
You know, for that 15, I mean, that's a hell of a return. And you see that, that's unreal money.
Right.
I mean, that's good money for anybody.
This guy, I never forget this guy. I don't know where he came from. To this day, me and my friends who survived that era, when we talk about this, none of us can pinpoint, or none of us can say emphatically where this guy came from. But I remember him like yesterday. He came into our neighborhood, and we were kids. We were kids. We was like 12, 13 years old at the time. And we full-fledged in the culture, right? He started teaching us. He taught us how to do what you just said, right? To take Superior B and make $1,000 off a $15 pack. And so he showed us that. And nobody else knew this at that particular time. And we would get Ether Base, the stuff called Ether Base. We would get Aura Gel to make it numb. We would get soda and we'd get orange juice. We was in the kitchen like chemists figuring this stuff out.
Yeah.
we would, and we almost burnt down a place or two because that ether base, when it hit fire, it just exploded. But we was figuring this stuff out, but it was fake crack cocaine at the particular time that we started making $5,000 and $6,000 almost every day.
A day.
Yeah. Well, a week when you combine it, but every day it was like, you know, we were making this money. Like we would spend that money and make it right back. All you had to do was just walk outside, right, and have some Superior B. Nobody knew it, and we would make. I was going to school at the time, $4,000 and $5,000, $6,000 in my pocket as a kid.
Oh my God!
Driving,
that's insane.
And I remember we had met this lady who owned a limo company, and we would pay her like for 8 hours at a time just to drive us around. I would be going to school. And I remember the principal saying, Richard, I was just telling somebody about this the other day. The principal was like, every day after school, principal would be like, hey, Lucky, your limo here. And I'd be like, all right.
Oh, my God. Oh, this is crazy.
And I'd be talking to like a group of girls, and I'd reach in my pocket and give them all like $20, $40 a piece. You know, it'd be 10 of them. And walk off, and that was a lot of money back then, junior high school, and so that became my introduction. No school, I was still trying to go to school, but yeah, by that time the culture had the headlocks on me.
Well, and how can it not? I mean, when you're making that kind of money,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and you're doing that, you feel important. You know, all of your, you know, here, and this, I remind the listeners, you're 14, right? And so,
right,
in a matter of months,
right,
you went from washing white walls,
right,
to making $5,000 to $7,000 a week,
right,
riding to school in a limo, passing out $20 bills to your friends and girls,
right?
I mean, that whole life. That's all a replacement, like we were talking about before,
right,
for those father figures and those, right, examples, right?
And you know, right. And when I look back at that particular time, and there may have been issue. I mean, there may have been some efforts that was targeted, like mentors, you know, boys and girls club. But it never reached me. You know, when I look back in hindsight, I can't say that there was some efforts or there was some organizations who was geared towards young men like me. I didn't see them. They were non-existent.
Right. Just in there. Well, it's because they weren't going into where it's happening.
Right, exactly.
Which is an important part of this story, which we'll talk about here. We'll get to, because I think that's what makes you unique. You
know, right.
You had the courage. You talked about the lack of courage.
Right.
You made up for that.
Right.
Know?
Right.
But we'll get to that in a second, because this didn't last very long, because you got caught in an undercover sting.
Right.
So you were riding high in the hog.
Right.
And you ended up selling drugs to an undercover cop. Now, okay, we're facing some real consequences here. And I think, is that right? Am I getting it right? This is when you went to the state,
right?
You run youth prison up in, it's closed now, but I think it was Glen Mills State School, I think was the name of it.
That's exactly what happened. And it was interesting how it happened. I, you know, sold to an undercover cop, and I actually got away, but my cousin, who had just got out of TYC, the Texas Youth Commission, I had rode off on my bike when they raided, and my cousin had just got out, and I turned around on my bike and seen that they had my cousin, and I went to paddling back so fast thinking I could help him, not knowing that they were looking for me. And so when they seen me, a van pulled out in front of me and said, "We got him." And that sent me to Glen Mills State School, you know.
So there you are. I mean, that's kind of when it hit you, right? And you would think in the time of the story, it's like, okay, now he's going to get straightened out. Because Glen Mills State School, that ain't no walk in the park, man.
Right.
That had a bad reputation, man.
Man, and that's a whole story in and of itself. My experience, my experience there.
But you're going there. Did you think when you were on the plane, and you know, I'm sure you saw when you're getting sentenced and your mother disappointment, grandparents disappointed, everybody disappointed in you. You're going 3,000 miles away from Dallas or however far it is. I mean, what were you feeling when that plane was taken off towards the facility?
That was my first time on an airplane ever. And I didn't know what to expect. I had a lot of fears because I didn't know what to expect. And again, for me, I think I was wearing the armor of the culture, but deep inside, yeah, I was just a little boy screaming for help, screaming for, you know, some kind of action, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so when I got off that plane, it was new. I remember getting off the plane and in the airport, these two big old white guys, man, they look like bodybuilders. They walked up to me. Okay. They say, all right, let's go. And then I asked them a question. I said, hey, where my bags at? You know, I don't know that you got to go to baggage check to get the bags. I'm like, where's my bag? I know I got on this plane with some bags. Where are they? And the guy grabbed me by my shirt, by my collar, and jacked me up in the middle of the airport. Said, little motherfucker, I'll kick your ass. You know, and I remember being like, whoa. I was like, whoa. And that was my introduction to Glenn Mills State School.
Well, yeah, it was a place. I mean, historically, it was founded in the early 1800s, right?
Right.
I mean, it was the Ivy League of juvenile correctional facilities, right? I mean, they didn't fuck around at this place.
They didn't. Right? They didn't play no games. They played no games.
And you were labeled when you got there as a quote unquote major concern, which is the lowest rank, the lowest kind of label that you can have. Like, this guy is a troublemaker.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure that pressure was hard on, it was harder on you than
average
day Joe, right?
Oh, yeah. When my first day there, on our way there, I was in the back seat with two other kids who they picked up from Dallas at the airport. And I'm reeling in the back seat because I'm still not trying, I'm still not registering why this guy grabbed me in the airport and jacked me up and said what he said to me. You know, my mind, I'm still stuck there. And so on our way to the facility, some kids threw some rocks and hit the car. You know how the kids rock the car. And the kids, the two dudes in the back seat with me started laughing, right? I didn't, because I'm still sitting here reeling off the fact that he grabbed my shirt. And the guy looks back at me and says to me, oh, you think it's funny? MF, you think it's funny, MF? He looked dead at me. Now I'm double mad because I didn't laugh. You jacked me.
It wasn't even you.
Yeah, and so when we get back to the facility, man, it was about five or six of these bodybuilding looking guys. They were all bodybuilding. I was probably about 145 pounds. And they circled me, right? And they went to taunting me. And next thing you know, they started pushing me around. And I'm little, and I lunged at one of them, and he picked me up. And next thing you know, I was flying across the room, and I landed on a stack of desks and chairs that was in the corner. And I remember hitting my side pretty hard, right? And I fell on the ground, and I looked up, and I said, this is real pain. This is not a dream. Like, this really happened. I really feel pain. And that was my introduction to the school. Like, I felt really pain. I'm like, whoa. And I looked in the, I remember looking up into the sky and saying, man, I'm like, I don't even know where I'm at. I got on an airplane. I don't even know where I'm at. And that, they labeled me a major concern. And it took me about 6 or 7 months to adjust to that, because this school was known for it. I'm quite sure you probably read the lawsuits that it had. This school was known for a harsh way that they treated those students there. You know, that's why it was some of the best, because they were known for that. And it took me a while. It took me a while to adjust to that, because, you know, they had pictures, big pictures hanging up where they had, some of the officers had threw me through the wall, you know, because I couldn't adjust. They just put a picture up. They threw me through those walls, those sheetrock walls, and put a picture up to cover what my body print was, because I couldn't get And I just didn't understand, like, these grown men were beating up on little kids like they were, you know, beating them into shape. And it took me a while.
It was an old school thing. But, you know, and it was peer-based too, which was weird, right? Which
right.
can be very effective where you get, first and foremost, they try to get the other
kids to do it.
Kids to do it, mm-hmm. which can be very effective. And then if not, but you started running, right?
I mean, yeah. you,
after this kind of, you get this major concern label off of you, you know, you do have some people that see some potential in you. You start running track.
Yes.
And you're clearing your mind. And I get that, right? I mean, that's how I made it through
right.
core training. Nothing compared to what I went through. But yeah, that physical release, right?
Yeah.
That where nobody's bothering you.
Yeah.
Getting all those endorphins going through your body and everything. It's a way to escape and survive that tremendous source, right? And it became right. a thing of pride for you, right? So here's, yeah. even though you're going through this kind of negative thing, some positive things start happening.
Right, exactly. And
you walk out of there a better young man.
I did. I went through those experiences, but it taught me a lot. You know, that's one of the things I said. It taught me a lot because prior to that, I didn't know how to give eye-to-eye contact. And you had to give eye-to-eye contact. You know, I didn't know how to use nonverbals and all that good stuff. But I learned that. I learned about being need and you know, a whole bunch of positive stuff that I learned there that I didn't. Some of the stuff that I think that your father would teach you, you know, I learned there, you know,
right.
manners and respect and all that. Yes, sir. No, sir. All that stuff that helps me today. I did learn it. And I left Glenn Mills feeling like I was better, you know, in spite of those situations. I left feeling like I was better. I'm like, I got a better shot at life. I'm finna go back and I'm finna put into practice everything that I've learned in this, all the good stuff that I learned. So I did leave feeling like that.
You're gonna go back to high school. You're gonna get on the track team. It's
right.
gonna be different.
Mm-hmm.
But man, the second you step back into East Dallas, man, you're already back in the game. You don't even know it.
Right, right.
And you don't even know it, but you were already there because it just sucks you in, right?
Right.
I mean, shortly after you get there, you're standing around with some friends, talking with your old friends, probably talking about how you almost busted your ribs at Glenn Mills or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you know, telling all your war stories.
Mm-hmm.
And then here comes this walk-by, right? Here comes these out of nowhere.
Right.
Two men come in there and start shooting the scene with AK-47s. Man, what
right.
the hell?
That's when I knew I was.
That's, and
that's when I knew. I said, you know, it's and it was interesting too, because I remember that day like it was yesterday, standing out just talking, and these dudes, not more than 100 feet away with AK-47, and started blasting directly at us. And
did anybody get killed? Anybody get hit?
I was standing by a car with. A little girl, she hadn't been no more than 5, and a little boy that had to be no more than 7. And I fell down by the car, and all you can hear was just like bullets hitting the car, glass shattering, glass.
Jeez.
And I'm reaching, trying to get the kids to get down, 'cause by then they crying and they screaming. So I'm telling them to get down. And out of that whole ordeal, which they shot probably over 200 times, you seen bricks coming off the wall, off the project building, and the little boy lost his finger. They shot him in the hand.
Boy lost his finger.
Lost his finger, and I remember seeing the blood. You know, I remember that the whole scene was so chaotic, and that right there just pushed me back into that mindset. And it was that.
Yeah, you were back in.
Yeah, it was that. That next day, we really declared ourselves the Bloods, and because we knew they were the enemy to the Crips, and
You found out that these guys were in the Crips, and so you next day you said, "All right, we're going to call ourselves the 415 Bloods," right?
Right.
So you started the Blood faction
mm-hmm.
there in East Dallas. That's when it was born in March or in. Spring of 1993.
Right. Correct.
Oh, man. And so now you're back in it, right? And so
right.
drive-bys and shootouts become a regular way of life, right?
Right.
And now you're in it, right?
Right.
And so now the entrepreneur starts to come out, right? Because now this neighborhood, because you kind of declared, you know, you're kind of the creator of the Bloods, and like now that this neighborhood becomes yours to exploit, right?
Right.
So you just right. start.
Right, right.
You just go full-fledged. I mean, what was that like? How there's a couple years there where, I mean, you're full on gangbanging. I mean, what are you doing? Like, how much are you making? I mean, what's happening?
Well, it became definitely one of those times where it was shootouts, you know, every day. We was confined to our neighborhood, you know, because at that time, it was probably 1993 to 95 was probably the most deadliest year for gangbanging in Dallas. And it's not nothing I'm proud of, but it did happen. And so we were confined to our neighborhoods and making money in our neighborhoods also kind of limited, you know, the ability to make more money, you know, because you're confined to your neighborhood. And so we were
doing. But you're running traps, right? I mean, you're running traps, and right. that's where you're making all your money.
Right? Right. Until 1995. So 1995 hit, gang stuff on the news, nightly news. 1995, the FBI raided my neighborhood. They had a 9 to 18 month investigation going on because of all of the violence that was happening. And they arrested 48 of my friends who I grew up with, kids, shot marbles, played school, played a house, hang-go see, you know, prison bell, 1, 2, 3 red light went into all the way into school. They arrested all those guys.
But they missed you, right?
They missed me. They came to my house. They came to my house. And you have to understand, Richard, back then, I had this pattern to where I would get up at 5 in the morning and leave my house because my mind always said that I knew that they were coming. I knew that I would be arrested at some point. I just didn't know when. And so my mind always said, leave early in the morning because they gonna come around 9 or 10 o'clock when they raid. And I would leave every morning from the house at like 5:36 in the morning, right? And just leave because I felt like they were coming to get me. And so on this particular day, March of 1995, I never sleep late. I never sleep past that time that I get up and I leave because I think the police is gonna raid come to my house. On this particular day, I overslept, and I never oversleep, and I never sleep hard, but I overslept. I woke up at 11:15, somewhere 11:20, right? And when I walk out my door, everybody in the facility is out, right? Everybody in the projects is out, and they run up to me and they say, "The feds were just at your house. They just left, et cetera, et cetera. Beating at your door, front and back." And I'm like, I didn't hear nothing. You know, I'm like, how did I not hear that? And so by this time, now I'm paranoid. You know, now I leave. But anyway, they end up arresting all of my friends. Fortunately, I didn't make the indictment. My name wasn't in the indictment that they had.
So that opens up a whole new opportunity for you. With all these names gone, now you're even a bigger name. You're a bigger fish in a smaller pond. You know, small pond.
So all of the guys who were running drugs in the neighborhood, they gone. It's like a ghost town. And so what ended up happening was, and my name was not on the list. So what ended up happening was, when all those guys left and I realized that it was just a one-time thing, my pharmaceutical entrepreneurship loans flipped into high gear. And so then, you know, I started back rolling. You know, I started, that was the neighborhood. That was, and again, I'm not proud of this stuff, but
it's important to the story.
Right, that's what happened. And so, with everybody gone, now I'm the big fish. You know, now I'm really clocking dollars. Now I'm really making money. You know, I got trap houses everywhere, but I'm making money. You know, and the lure of that money that I was making had a stranglehold.
Oh, that'd be huge.
Yeah, it had a stranglehold on me. You know, I was I was spending probably $700-$800 a week just on my cleaner's bill, getting my clothes out the cleaners. Yeah. Cause I would never wear the same thing.
You know, and the ironic thing is, or I think our irony is the right thing, is that making all that money did afford you some freedom. You were talking about this dual lifestyle you were living when you were a kid with the good grades. You're kind of doing the same thing here because right. this did afford you some freedom. Now, you're not physically selling the drugs. You're the man running the show.
Right.
You can escape the neighborhood. You go somewhere else. And you're starting to have relationships
right.
with girls that are going to nice schools, nice right. neighborhoods. And so you're living this dual life.
Right.
And so it had to feel pretty good on one hand, but on the other hand, it had to be conflicting as hell.
Oh, it was definitely conflicting. You're absolutely right. It afforded me the opportunity to not be in the hood. You know, it afforded me the opportunity to get out the hood. It afforded me the opportunity to see other things, which I was
different life,
a different right. lifestyle that I was seeing. You know, because I was hardly in the hood, I was seeing other stuff, but I was still conflicted because, you know, that was how I was making my money. And
it's like, yeah, you're trying to figure out, how do I get out of this?
How do I get out of this? You know, what's my exit plan? You know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, because just the stuff that you deal with in that lifestyle, you have to numb parts of you that care to even be a part of that lifestyle. And that stuff was taking its toll on me. It was wearing on me.
Yeah.
And I probably was the only person who thought like this, who thought like, you know, had this conflicting feeling. You know, anybody else was probably just full-fledged, I'm making money, I'm about to profit, et cetera, et cetera. But I was also looking at the devastation of the neighborhood. I was looking at, you know, some of my friends' mothers and stuff who was on crack. You know, I thought about my mother, boyfriend who ended up selling crack. That stuff was weighing heavy on me. I thought about it a lot, you know.
Well, it runs out. The luck runs out on you.
Right.
And you get caught in another undercover sting, even though you're physically not selling the drugs.
Right.
You get caught. Well, now you're looking at real prison time. Here.
Right. I mean,
the game's kind of up. You also found out that this nice girl, I think her name was Kenyatta. Kenyatta. She's pregnant while you're out on bail waiting for your trial and all that story. You're sentencing or whatever.
Right.
And anyway, fast forward, you end up in prison.
Yeah.
I mean, you're doing hard time in a real prison now.
Right.
And how old are you?
I'm 19 at the time. I was 19. Kenyatta tell me she's pregnant. I'm out on bond. Now I'm really contemplating my life. Like, I got to do something. I got to do something different because this prison is looming over my head. Then I'm starting to think about, you know, my father who left me and how I felt and that I'm repeating this same cycle again. How do I get in this cycle and et cetera? I'm starting to retrace a lot of stuff, thinking about a lot of stuff. And so I would, and this is probably something I did that I don't think nobody else did. I started going down to the courthouse while I was out on bond and just watching the drug cases happen, right? And
right.
trying to figure out what's my best defense, et cetera. And what I would see, though, was shocking to me, and it was eye-opener. What I would see, though, in terms of that, I would see in these cases, you had a black defendant who was charged. You had a white prosecutor, you had an all-white jury, and you had an all-white judge. And then day in and day out, you had guilty sentences, right? I saw that day in.
Empathy or understanding what's really going on.
Right. So I'm starting to become conscious of stuff because now I'm in the rat trap. So I want to understand the rat trap, and I'm starting to see it. And so fast forward, I was standing in court. I was expecting to go home. My daughter was born.
You really didn't have a record.
I didn't have a record. I didn't have a record. So at minimum, I was eligible for probation, a drug case. And so my daughter was born May 7th, May 21st. I was standing in front of the judge expecting to go home. I even had character witnesses to say, man, he's not a bad kid. He did some stuff, but he's not a bad kid. And that judge said that I was a menace to society and sent me to prison. And so I remember standing there when he said that to me, right? In my mind, this when it became real. In my mind, I was saying, Judge, you don't understand. Like I'm really not a bad guy. You know, I'm just from a bad neighborhood. And in my neighborhood, Judge, you have to be this way in order to survive. That's not really who you are. You just gotta be. Right. But that never came out of my mouth. It was just like that. And then at the same time, I'm afraid to go to prison.
Sure.
So the judge saying that I'm a menace to society, and here I am having this conversation, afraid to go to prison. You know what I'm saying? You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
He's saying you're a menace to society. You belong in prison. And I'm sitting here having a conversation about, Judge, you don't understand. That's not who I am. I just had to be that. And I'm afraid to go to prison.
I'm scared.
I'm scared.
Help. Yeah, you're still calling for help.
Exactly. But fortunately for me, go ahead.
Yeah, how much time? I was going to ask, how much time were you given?
He gave me 7 years. I was facing 5 to 99, but he gave me 7 years. 7 years.
So you go there, and I know there's so many details. I'm just looking at the clock, thinking, God, how can I get all this great story here? But you know, there's a couple of people, a couple of things happened that really stood out to me in your story. Because number one, Fats introduced you to the mom Fareed, who definitely.
Right.
Instrumental in changing your path, right?
Right, right.
It's almost like God said, okay, I'm putting you here so you can meet Fareed.
Right.
The librarian, right?
Right.
That you meet, the old woman, I don't remember what her name was.
Yeah.
The 60-year-old librarian.
Yeah.
You know, you start reading 16 hours a day, dude.
Yes.
I mean, you're reading.
Yeah. Yes.
And yeah. the imam sees something in you, you know?
Right.
And you get introduced to the Muslim faith.
Yeah.
And the part that really struck to me, still gives me chills thinking about it, is that because he saw something in you.
Right, right.
He's been observing you. He comes up and he says, little brother, he goes, you are a natural leader.
Wow.
And that's the first time
somebody
ever said that.
Wow.
I think that, to me, dude, I think that's divine intervention right there.
Man, that was the defining moment for me. That was the defining moment for me because when he said those words to me, and the way that he said those words to me was important too. He said, I've been watching you. He said, these guys been paying homage to you. They do whatever you say. They fall out of place. They follow all of your orders. He said, I've been watching you. He said, if you can lead these guys to do wrong, little brother, you have the same ability to lead them to do right. You're a leader.
Yeah.
So you should leave. And I was shocked. You know, it was like, it caught me by surprise, but it spoke to my soul. It spoke to where I was at that particular, it was the exact words that I needed to hear if I was to change my life or change my trajectory in life. Those words pierced my soul so hard that he sent me on this path to discover and find myself and reconnect with who I really am, that I credit him for. I give him all the credit.
Yeah, I love that.
Had we not intervened, had he not said anything to me, I can't honestly say I'd be sitting on this podcast with you because I could have went the other
100%.
Way. Yeah, I could have went the, I went agree. Into prison with, I went into prison as the leader of the blood. So that came with some perks. And so
so you're already a target in there.
Right.
And so it's just, the cycle's just going to perpetuate itself.
Right. Right.
If he hadn't come up and kind of infused that kind of vision in you or whatever that happened, you're gonna be doing the exact same thing that you're doing on the outside.
Right.
Because you got to survive in prison.
Right. Exactly.
And so, yeah. And so you, I don't know how long, was it a year or a couple of years now? Your 21st birthday that you really embraced Islam.
Right.
Less than about 4 months after you entered prison.
Right. Right. There. Right. Yeah.
And so that helps too. So I think, you know, living that upright life, you know, taking that kind of at least live an upright life to establish peace wherever you may go. I mean, that's
right.
Heavy.
Right.
I mean, if you really believe it. And so you embraced it and you're trying to denounce the old way in prison, and you get tested a handful of times.
Yes. Yes.
Like people that you know, and hey, we're old school, man. We come from the same. And you're like, yes. It ain't me anymore, man. It's mm-hmm. not me.
I started reading, and once I started learning a lot about myself, that propelled me to places that I could have never imagined, like the relationship with the librarian. Who would ever thought that I would develop a relationship yeah. and we would talk about life and things that, and we related in such a way that it made it clear for me. I began to teach, but I'm going to tell you one thing that I did. I'm going to tell you one thing that I did that I don't want to miss is, That experience helped me look into the mirror, right?
Right.
And it allowed me to accept and it allowed me to process everything that I've dealt with up until that point. Because I became very, very introspective to everything and every idea, every influence that happened to my life. I retraced my life till when I was a kid. And where I went off track, and I was able to accept, and I accepted everything that happened up until that point. You know, because I didn't want to be the one who blamed it on the system. I didn't want to be the one who blamed it on my mother. I didn't want to be the one who blamed it on my father not being there. Because at the end of the day, I had to accept that I made the choices that I made, and for me to get to the next stage in my life, I had to accept that. I couldn't blame nobody else for that. I had to accept it. And I did that. And that's looking into the mirror. That's becoming very, very vulnerable. You know, as in this society, as men, we're taught to be very masculine and you don't cry and you don't accept and you can't be weak and all that stuff. And I think that kind of messaging is what keeps people from really self-actualizing to the next level, because you're taught that to express your feelings is weakness. But what I've learned, being able to accept everything that came with the choices that I made became my strength. It became my medicine, you know, and it became my medicine.
That's beautiful that you said that, because it is, we began the show saying it's a story of redemption, which is true, but a huge part of that redemption umbrella is that accountability that you're talking about. And exactly. To get to that accountability piece is, like you said, to get extremely authentic, transparent, and vulnerable with yourself.
Man.
That is a huge part of accountability that a lot of people don't fully realize. And that is exactly what you did. You're exactly 100% right.
Yes.
And it is meeting the imam. It is
right.
The old librarian and talking about life. And
I met so many men in prison who had an excuse for every solution that you can bring right. to them, that I felt that was a problem. I met so many men who were just afraid. Because one thing I learned though was, even for myself, all those layers that I put on, I was a good kid who encountered a stimuli in my environment that made me amputate my personality, my good kid personality, to become somebody else. The gang was an example of that. That was another layer that I put on, you know, to protect myself. And so in prison, right, when I began to really deal with myself and start dealing with other men, I was able to see how they put layers on as well. You know, I had a friend. Yeah. I had a friend who was the head of the Aryan Brotherhood, man, who became my friend, right? And this guy had tattoos from head to toe. Swastikas, everything from head to toe, right? But when I found myself, you naturally have that propensity to want to find others, help others find themselves. And so when I would have conversations, I remember guys used to see me in the day room and they'd be like, what in the world is Luck doing over there talking to that guy, right? But what I found was in our conversations that we had a lot of commonality that We cared about family. We cared about just a lot of stuff that's in common. But we too
right.
had these layers that we put on. We put these layers on that prevents us from having true human connection, right? So when I started having these conversations, I began to see his tattoos. All the tattoos, one that he was a mean individual not to be messed with, as you would think. The tattoos were to ward you off because he didn't want you to mess with him. Because he was just like me, a kid, just as I put on a gang to protect me, put on this gang identity to protect me. He put those tattoos on to protect him, and we were the same. We're the same individual, and this is, you know, and this is the message that I had for a lot of prisoners, a lot of men that I was coming in contact with. That when we began to unlayer these layers and be vulnerable and be transparent with each other, that's when the real magic happens for you. It's scary though. It's scary when you layered yourself for 15 or 20 years. And now someone asking you to unlayer yourself, and this all you know is scary. But I was fortunate enough to get a great deal of men to unlayer themselves, just as I had done, who became brothers, man, who became very different individuals and very different people.
I mean, there's so much. I'm looking at the clock, and I feel like we need to do a part two on this.
We definitely got to do a part two. I was about to tell you that. Yes, I would love to.
I mean, but I want the listeners to know and to tease them for this part two. It's like, I mean, we just got to the point to where here you are in prison and you met their mom. You actually go to another prison in Palestine, Texas, which is like, I mean, that's a hell on earth place.
Yes.
And you lead people there and you meet all these relationships. And eventually you get out on parole and you meet the late Bishop Omar.
Yes.
And you guys start making a real impact in the community there in Dallas and doing contrarian things about right. How you look at school, how you look all this stuff. That I want to talk about that in the second episode. But yes. I think, because I know I got to be respectful of your time, you got another meeting here in about 5 minutes. And I think we pick up part two with that. Let's talk a little bit about when you went to Palestine, Texas, and then right. How the great work that you did, the contrarian work that you did. With Bishop Omar confronting the Crips in their right. own territory, walking up. That's a story that I want people to hear. So I'm just teasing them so they'll tune into the second episode here.
Yes.
And then all the great work that you're doing with the urban specialists now. I want to hear all about that. And I think it's I don't want to rush through it because there's so much important things that we need to touch base on. So let's leave it at that, Anton, so I can be respectful of your time. But what do you want people to know until we can schedule a second episode here? What do you want people to walk away with from this episode?
I want people to understand that that adversity, all the things that go through, that you go through in life and that you will go through, that's meant to take you out. You have the ability to turn it around. You have the ability, you have access to turn that stuff around because that's your medicine. And your medicine oftentimes is not for you, it's for others. So when we do part two, we're gonna talk about how everything that we just talked about up until this point, how I was able to turn that into my medicine and to helping other people. But I want them to walk away understanding in part two, we're going to show you how the correlation of the work that we do now is connected to that.
Beautiful. Yeah. I look forward to it, man. Anton, I love this. I love you. I love what you're doing.
Love too.
And I look forward to doing the part two. Yes. All right, my friend. Until part two, we'll sign off.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, thanks so much for tuning into the show. I hope you got some value out of this episode. If you did, please do me a huge favor. Tell somebody about this show. Tell your spouse, tell your kids, tell your coworkers. Let them know about the value that Dose of Leadership brings to your world. Go to doseofleadership.com. You can learn more about my services. If you're looking for somebody to speak, teach, or coach about leadership, I'm your guy. I'm known for my ability to transform individuals and organizations, teaching them the concept of creating a culture of decentralized leadership. I do think that is the secret sauce to facing all the challenges that we face today. Thanks so much for tuning into the show. I look forward to the next time we work together. And until the meantime, make it a great one.